Hey, Jess here. If you've been listening to the Am Writing Podcast, you know that we have a new sponsor, The Great Courses Plus, and I could not be more excited. I have been a customer for decades. This week, I'm listening to a course, Behavioral Economics, When Psychology and Economics Collide by Scott Hutel of Duke University, because my college kid is an economics and math major, and I hate sounding like an idiot in front of him, so I am learning everything I need to know to sound a little bit more informed about economics. The Great Courses Plus is so much fun for that reason. You can learn a little of this, a little of that. You can dive in. You can go deep on a survey course. You can go for one lecture here and there. It's a fantastic service. The Great Courses Plus has a little something for everyone. You can download the Great Courses Plus app to watch or listen. You can do either one on any device, anytime you want. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting and you can get an entire month of unlimited access for free. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting. What do you want to learn about this week?
The recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delatonia, and this is #AmWriting, the podcast about writing all the things, fiction, nonfiction, short pieces, long pieces, pitching, proposals, freelance work, and articles, which is going to be today's topic. In short, this is, as I say nearly every week, the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 plus romance novels. My latest one is called Lover Boy. And you can always find me at the ebook distributor of your choice or at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters and the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent. I'm the former editor and lead writer of the Motherload blog at the New York Times, where I still occasionally contribute. And I am working on novel number 2 or novel number 3, depending on which one is doing what at any given moment. And we have a guest today who's sitting in waiting for me to introduce her, and we're super excited to talk. We are going to talk today with Lisa Levenstein. She is director of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program and associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She specializes in 20th century U.S. women's and gender history, and she's got 2 books: A Movement Without Marches, African American Women in the Politics of Poverty in Postwar Philadelphia, and They Didn't See Us Coming, The Hidden History of Feminism in the 90s. And I read you her bio that way because we are specifically hoping to talk to Lisa about taking the topic that you are passionate about in other parts of your life and turning it into work that can be placed in a freelance way in publications all across the country. So that's we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the impact of COVID on that particular activity and also on us as women, because that's part of Lisa's specialty, and that's what we're going to do. So hi, Lisa. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me. I've been such a listener since the beginning, I feel like. So it's such a thrill to be interviewed.
So let me start. You had a recent piece on the childcare crisis that's been created by COVID in the Washington Post, and that the way that you wrote that, it obviously plays into your experience with, you know, with history and it had sort of an academic, bit to it, because it had a real historic flair. It's about how history teaches us that we could solve this childcare crisis. But what I really did, and the reason that I wanted to talk about it, is you took something that is happening to millions of us and turned it into something that was interesting for people to hear from you. And I wanted to talk about how you pulled that off.
Well, thank you for those words. I think, first of all, something I want to say is that The Washington Post isn't where I started in terms of being able to, well, this piece it was, but in general, when it comes to taking something that is from me and from my specialty as an academic and turning it into a piece that the public might be interested in and trying to bridge those two gaps. And when I first started thinking that I wanted to be able to bridge kind of the academia and writing for a more public audience, my first thought was basically like the New York Times are bust, right? And so I kept sending all these things into the New York Times because that to me was what writing for a public audience was somehow, right? And of course, I, you know, one rejection came after another. I don't even think you get rejected. They just say if you haven't heard from them in X amount of weeks, forget it, right? And so what I learned, though, was that a way to start making these connections, but what for me, and I think really for a lot of people, is to start locally. And so I started pitching to my local paper. And there I found a much more receptive audience because it turns out that the people who were running those op-ed pages are actually eager for new perspectives. They were eager to hear from someone who teaches at their, you know, has a local connection, who teaches at the college in their city. They were much more eager to hear from me and much more welcoming. And so that is where I started. I wouldn't want listeners to get the idea that I just immediately went, you know, started writing for the, you know, for publications like the Post.
Yeah, because no, I'm really so glad started, you put it that way.
It really started much more about getting my feet wet, doing these kinds of columns for the local paper. And I think the cool thing about writing for a local paper today is that you have a link, right? So you can then share it so broadly that it matters less, I think, what right. publication it is. Just getting it out there is the key, really.
Right.
It's also a confidence builder, right? Like, all of the major newspapers and online venues can just seem like a monolith until you get that first clip.
I think that's really true. It gives you a sense that you can do this and of the process and how it's going to go. And then also it gives you that first connection, which for me was really crucial because then I was no longer submitting through the portal. I had the people who I was working with on the piece, I had their personal email addresses, right? So I could then just send pieces directly to them when I was interested. And we started to develop a relationship so that by that, you know, soon within a few years, they were contacting me, you know, to say, hey, this is happening. Might you write something? And that was just felt so good. And like such a different kind of relationship. So it really felt really important to start building locally. And then, you know, and I live in North Carolina. So it was first the newspaper in my city, and then it was other cities in North Carolina, right? So kind of building out, and then an online publication. So it was kind of building, I think, Serena, what you're saying exactly right, kind of building my confidence, but also building really a network of people who I had some interactions with.
This is great. This is exactly how I got started when I was doing it. And that was many, many years ago, and at least partly in print. But, you know, that's the thing to do, is to find these smaller things. But what's really also important about the way that you have approached is that you didn't stop pitching the larger things as you got more experience. How did you manage not to just go, well, I've got this great gig going with people who are, you know, going to make me feel good about myself. Maybe I should give up pitching people who might say no.
Yeah, I think that is while the local pieces are tremendously fulfilling and really can have a very broad reach, it's fun to publish for other kinds of publications because if a local newspaper is a certain kind of audience. And as you all know, right now with the media landscape like it is, there's other times my work right now is on feminism. So there's some messages, some things I want to say to audiences who are already interested in the topic, right? Mm-hmm. Who I might be pitching to a more like women's focused publication. There are other times I want to write to people who I feel like I need to interest them in the topic, which is more the post piece that you're talking about, and explain to them why this matters. And these are really different audiences. And they're also, you know, the North Carolina audience is a specific kind of audience. And I did want to sometimes be speaking beyond that. And so that is what, you know, had me think about keeping going with these other publications. Now, granted, I still have not made the New York Times. It's still on my list. When you made the New Yorker KJ, I felt like that was such a moment. I can so relate. To me, that's going to be my New York Times moment if it ever happens. But
you'll get there.
I can completely relate to that. But I do. It has been important to keep trying. And it is true that you're much more likely to get rejected from some of these other places. And I have gotten a lot of rejections, but you can often still find a place for that piece wherever it is. It might not be the first time that you try, but trying again, trying somewhere else, that it actually has proven to work, I've found. And it can also be...
So that was going to be my next question, was how do you... What's your process of sort of pitching to maybe the top thing, and then I'm guessing you make changes before you keep going, or do you pitch multiple things at once? How do you approach that piece of it?
It's become more purposeful over time. I think in terms of thinking, right, when I'm writing the piece, like, who is this for? What is the audience that I'm thinking about? And in right now, many of my more recent pieces have come out of the book that I just wrote. And so that has involved working with the publicist for Basic Books, which is where I published the book. And she would kind of say, okay, well, now we should pitch something to Ms. Magazine, for example, right? Like, what part of this would be best suited for that? And we would kind of strategize about what would be good there. And then what I've learned from her that I didn't really understand before is you can send a teaser to places, right? You could kind of send almost like a mini proposal, like the first paragraph or something of a piece, send it out, see if there's interest. And then when they say, yeah, we'd be interested in that, then you can write the entire piece. I didn't understand this when I was starting out. I was writing fully formed pieces that I then sent out. And now I'm learning that there's much more of a kind of back and forth that can go on before you necessarily sign up to write a piece. And that's been a helpful and really kind of new experience for me that I've just learned in working with this publicist. I didn't have a publicist before. This is the first time I've written for a trade press. And so now to have someone strategizing about this with
that's
me has
cool.
been a lot of fun and really felt pretty, pretty empowering, right?
What does a pitch look like when you send it out? Like, what does your subject line look like? What kind of thing do you put in there to get the editor to read the teaser?
So usually I'm a historian, so I'm often trying to give a historical perspective on something happening today. And that can be a challenging thing to do. So there needs to be a really clear link between the history and the current issue and a sense that this is something that's really important that we need to look at now, right? So I can't just be, I don't lead with the history. I lead with why this is mattering right now. And then then there's a teaser of why this historical context that I'm going to provide is really going to give us a new angle onto this issue that we're looking at today.
But seriously, like, what would your subject line look like? Like, how do you get them to pull that email out of their pile?
That's a great question, and one that I'm not sure I have a good answer for.
Well, I'll tell just to throw out there, because I'm still doing this. Like, I still pitch places that I have never written for. So I'll put my biggest. So if I were you, I would put, maybe something like historian WashPo opinion writer with story on, or something like pitch colon, and then your biggest experience and your other, like, but you got to keep it super short. So, like, yeah, it'd be like pitch colon historio/WashPo op-ed writer on, how whatever
COVID and the childcare crisis or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And because you want them to see, like, you're not just somebody. Like you've absolutely got some gravitas. You got some cred.
Well, one of the things that I did do something I know you've been involved with, KJ, the op-ed project has workshops for really often many of them are geared towards academics who are just notoriously terrible with writing for the public. And it's something we're not taught and we need to be taught it in the way that the op-ed project runs these workshops for us. And what they talk about shiny baubles, right? At the beginning, when they talk about how you introduced yourself, and they talk about how women in particular tend not to lead with all of, the reasons that people should listen to them, right? Yeah. So that I was introducing myself and I wasn't even saying that I was a professor, right? And they're like, well, maybe that might be something you want to mention in trying to build your credibility, right? And it was amazing. They had us all go around the room and introduce ourselves as we would if we were pitching. And it turned out that many of us were burying the lead. Right. There were people who had won huge awards, done all kinds of amazing stuff, and they were not sharing that when they were pitching themselves. And, a kind of sense of modesty. And the people who were running this workshop just said to us, no, this is not the time to be modest. Right. This is the time, as you said, I'm so interested that you referred to me in that way. I wouldn't have done that about myself. Right. But we need to learn to lead with our credentials and lead with the things that are going to get people's notice. And I think that doesn't come naturally necessarily all the time.
And there are no credentials police. This is something that Serena and Jess and I talk amongst ourselves pretty frequently. Nobody is looking at your thing to say, well, I don't know if I'd call you a historian. I mean, I think people would call you a historian, but there is no... there's nobody checking those things. What you need to do is pull the things from your bio that are most, closest, that are going to intrigue somebody and that present you in the absolute best light. And, sure, if I say WashPaw op-ed writer, does that maybe suggest that you've written 1,000 of them? Yeah, but nobody's going to question that. You've written a couple. It's good enough.
And once you get the sticker, it can never be taken away from you.
That's right.
So KJ is a New York Times bestselling author forever now.
Forever now. Yeah. Yeah. I'm having it tattooed right here underneath New York Times writer, which is how I used it when I was pitching. I would put that first. That would go first. NY Times writer with piece on, organizing during COVID for Real Simple or Weather. That's how I bill myself, even though I'm not employed by them anymore. And that's okay. There's nobody to tell me that I can't do that because I can do that because... that's how people do it, right? So then is the first line of your pitch, is it who you are and why you should be the one to write? Or is it the teaser?
It's usually the teaser is the way I've done it, is the teaser about why this is going to be a great piece, something that they haven't heard of, something that's going to bring a new dimension to the public conversation, somehow really trying to say it in a pithy way, and just in a few sentences. And it's something I'm still learning because as you probably, if you've worked with any academics, we tend to be, people give too much detail, too wordy, too in the weeds, right? Bury the lead. All of that stuff is, kind of almost it's stuff we learn as we get professionalized that I've had to unlearn. And has been, but it's really a process of discovery for me, this kind of unlearning and learning to write a new way. It's been fabulous. It's keeping me alive, really, keeping me energized. But at the same time, it has required a kind of mind shift in terms of how we do our work.
Well, that kind of gets a little bit to something else that I wanted to ask you about. So a lot of the topics that you talk about passionately and that are the topics in your book are what I would call sort of evergreen topics. How family leave affects working women, how the need for subsidized daycare changes parents' experiences in various places. And one issue that often comes up for academics trying to turn those into opinion pieces is why now? And so I wanted to ask you how you get past, because that's what editors are like, well, yeah, Why now? And the answer is because we don't have these things yet. But that's not enough, right? You always need what they call a topical hook. So I wondered how you try to find the things to hook your passions into to interest editors.
That's a great question. I'm not as good at doing what I think some people do, which is have a bunch of things on the burner that they can just, you know, like kind of write most of a few pieces and then wait for that moment when that issue comes into the public consciousness. And then you just slap a little, you know, a few lines on the top to link it to what's going on right now. And you have that ready to go when you send it out. I've found it difficult to write like that. I wish I could do more of that because I think it would be super productive. But it's usually been for me that the issue comes up at that moment and I just see it. I see what, you know, I see, for example, the issues around childcare. It was very clear to me that started to really get some attention when COVID hit. It was really clear to me that we are lacking an understanding that this was something the U.S. have done in the past and could do again, you know, without too much difficulty, right? In terms of having the government step in to provide childcare for people who were in need and not just poor people, but for all people, right? That this is something that we've tried and it's happened and it was successful and we could do it again. So that to me, it was just immediately obvious. But I think the smarter way to do it or the more productive way would be to have a few of these things going that you could then call up, right? When the mood strikes, when the issue becomes hot, because it is some of the biggest challenges I've had in placing pieces have been the ones that are not, that are just about issues I feel are important, but aren't necessarily current to today. You know, that aren't making headlines at that moment, that aren't even in the lifestyle section. That is that to kind of get into the discourse in that way, I think is a whole other hurdle that is very, very challenging to do. And it's much easier if the issue is already being talked about and you can provide a different kind of angle on that issue or in some, and even if it's kind of a tenuous link, right? Just a way to get your idea out there, even if it's not necessarily even directly connected, but you can hook it to what the public conversation is. I think that really matters. And I think that really helps. I mean, there's also, honestly, I think some luck involved in the whole process, for me at least. For example, the childcare pieces that I wrote in the Post, well, it so happened that the person who was on the front lines going through the pitches was herself dealing with a childcare crisis, right? Was herself at that time doing two jobs and had kids that she was, and she said, this is my life. Like that's what she, you know, and she pushed for the piece to go in, the first one, at least she pushed for it and felt really herself committed to it because it was something that touched her personally. And that was, you know, a fortunate coincidence, really.
Yes. If it had dropped into a 65-year-old dude's lap, he would have been like, so?
Exactly.
Yet one time, one of the first things I ever pitched was related to skiing. And the person who picked it up first said, I just got back from a ski trip. So that timing, you know, happens sometimes and it's serendipity. But there's another, some people get really good at training themselves to see these opportunities. Like I don't pitch news stories anymore. I don't see the world that way. But our co-host Jess Leahy is, you know, pitching the most news stories among us. And she has basically trained, it's like that Cheers quote, like I've trained myself to dream about your space. Well, she's trained herself to dream about, you know, topical hooks with headlines.
That's great training to have, really. And it's interesting, what I have been able to do as well, though, is has been to take, for example, I'm thinking about the childcare piece. I was able to almost pitch it twice because I published the piece in the Post and then I sent that piece to my local NPR station. And who, again, I'd like to emphasize, it's our local NPR. It's North Carolina NPR. It's, at first I was also kind of like fresh air or bust, right? And then I realized that, wow, people, you know, in North Carolina and my local NPR station actually might be interested in having me on. And, you know, and that I could, and I've also now developed a relationship with them. And so they usually talk to me about my books or other kinds of things, or if they need a kind of expert on women's issues. And I had published this piece on childcare in the Post, and I just sent it to them. And I said, hey, this might be an issue you're interested in covering. And, you know, turns out it was. And then, so you can also, I think that's been an interesting window into the process for me, that it's like a publication can beget something else. And that these, and if you can, you can really make a lot out of something if you are willing to kind of put yourself out there and know that maybe sometimes the answer is going to be no. But it's
right.
Okay.
But if you don't ask, the answer is always no.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. And that can still, you know, open more doors when other NPR stations hear you. They do. They've almost all got an hour long talk show that's sort of trolling for topics. And, you know, I bet you could sell childcare and COVID to our NPR station right now to their hour-long talk show, because they're looking for stuff like that. And that's what people are interested in and want to call in and talk about. So, yeah. So does doing this stuff help you in your academic career, do you think?
It, in terms of things like salary raises or promotions or anything like that, absolutely not. In terms of being able to help me think about things in new ways, and really distill issues down to their essence in a way that I find very intellectually productive, absolutely, right? So it's not like, it's not a kind of career building thing in so far as the academia doesn't reward really people writing for a public audience. They like it if you do, and the people who are like the media people for my university are always happy if I write something and they want to put it out there, but it doesn't get me anything.
They have no power.
Right, exactly. It doesn't get me anything kind of professionally, but it does. But I find it tremendously intellectually challenging and rewarding, and that it helps me think in another way. And I think every time we're thinking in different ways, that is an enriching way to be. It's an enriching thing to do. So I feel like it's absolutely helped me to become a deeper and more interesting thinker, to have to push myself not just to think about the academic audience, but to think about other kinds of audiences.
What advice would you give somebody who has their own, who has a specialty, whether it's an academic specialty or something else, you know, a teacher or someone who's worked in restaurants and is experiencing that and is interested in trying to share that story and their experience with their local paper, or, you know, just more who's interested in trying to write about it and get it out there?
One of the things I've been so I've worked with a lot of other academics in particular, but I think this might be more broadly translatable as well. And one of the things I've been so interested to see is the people tend to think, what people think they need in order to be an expert in something, right? So I have people who have PhDs in like American history, and someone will say, will you write something for us? Can you write something for us about World War II? And they'll think, well, I'm not a specialist in World War II. Even though they've taught about World War II for two decades, they know, like they've read maybe 20 books on the topic, right? I mean, they know a lot about it. They'll think, well, I'm not a specialist. I'm not the one to write that. Who am I to write this thing when other people have spent their whole careers only looking at World War II? And right, and so, but it, and so this idea that I think kind of what you were saying before about claiming titles, claiming expertise, it's the same thing here. Mm-hmm. You know what? No, you aren't. You may not be the only expert in the country on working in a restaurant.
Right.
You might not be the only person who understands these issues, but you understand them and you have your own take on them, because we all do, right? And so you actually, you have the authority to write about things for a public audience. That's all you need. And it's been fascinating to me to see even people with PhDs, believe they're not expert enough to be able to weigh in on a particular topic. And so, and I think that it's not unique to academia, that people in all kinds of walks of life don't realize the things that they have expertise in that the world would want to know about, that they have a cool right. take on, an interesting idea about, a really neat experience that they've had that would enrich other people's lives if they shared it.
Yeah, or just, I mean, most people submitting are journalists and writers in various ways. So if you're, you know, a journalist writer, you know, if you're somebody who wants to be a writer, but you also have, you know, a huge other role, whether it's, you know, working in a small business or, you know, hiring for restaurants or something like that, it's, you start by writing about that. Because honestly, that's the voices that opinion pages in particular, they don't get. All they ever get is me. They're like, really, we're tired of you. You know, bring us somebody who's actually done something besides write for us. It's good advice. Well, unless you have something else that I really should have hit, I feel like now is a great time to just take a little moment, thank our sponsors, and then come back and talk about what we've been reading. Hey, listeners, if you've been hanging with us for a while, you've heard us talk about Author Accelerator's book coach training and book coach matching services more than once. But here's a question we've never answered. Do you have to have written a book to become a book coach? Answer, nope. Book coaching, the art of guiding a writer into creating the best possible book at this moment in their career, is its very own thing, not unlike editing. How many novels did Maxwell Perkins write? Zero, and that was fine with F. Scott Fitzgerald. Well, okay, apparently it got a little weird and possibly more than a little complicated, but bear with me here. What I'm saying is that if becoming a book coach has been noodling around your dreams, but you're afraid you don't have the experience, you need to put aside those fears and head over to Author Accelerator to learn more about how to take your passion for story and use it to help other writers get to where they want to be. Find out more at bookcoaches.com/amwriting. Okay. All right. It's time. I hope you've been reading some good stuff because I want to hear about it. Lisa, you start.
I just finished a book. One of the books, these books that you just read in two nights. It's called Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close. It's written by two women who, if you've heard the podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, they are the hosts of a podcast that's really about female friendship and about, and it's really, the podcast is very much based in their very close, intimate relationship and their dialogue with one another. Well, it turns out when you read the book, you find out that that friendship isn't quite what has met the eye. In fact, their friendship has been complicated. And to the degree to which they went into kind of couples therapy for their friendship.
Ooh, that's cool.
Right? And so they use this book to kind of tell the story of their friendship, how it evolved over time, and how these like little warning flags were popping up, but they ignored them and they tried not to deal with them until it really got to the point where they had to really confront some of like kind of central issues in their relationship. So you hear about their relationship and how they've kind of worked it out over time and how it's changed as they've moved to other places and, you know, gone, became business partners with this podcast. But it's also really a book about relationships in general and the need to care for them that you know, yeah. In a way you don't just need to do this with a marriage, you know, or a kind of long time partnership in that way, but you also need to do this with all kinds of relationships, and that relationships change. They change over time and you need to pay attention to them and see how they're changing and respond. And so it's not really an advice book, but I felt like I got a lot of advice from reading it. And it's a good read. And I just felt like it was sent a really important message, especially right now where, like we're all kind of, relationships are really what we have.
Right.
And so I have really enjoyed it.
It sounds like it's good reading for us fiction writers too, because I feed a lot of my fiction by reading about, you know, people who are really willing to write openly and honestly about their relationships. Serena, read anything good lately?
Well, I've continued my Ellen Hildebrand rabbit hole, and particularly with interest on her series books where she manages a nice cliffhanger after each one, and I've just really gotten a lot out of it. So this week's was a book called What Happens in Paradise.
I think I've read that one. I have really, I've started and abandoned two books in the last week. They just weren't hitting it. I'm reading something now. I'm not finished with it. I think it's going to nail the landing. I'm feeling pretty good about it, so I guess I'll tell you about it. It is called The Unlikely Adventures of the Shergill Sisters, and it's the story of three sisters whose mother dies and asks them to take a pilgrimage to India to scatter her ashes. And they've all got secrets, and they're none of them super... I'm struggling a little bit because I don't have a great deal of... Not every character has to be likable, but they're lacking in likability in a way that I'm having a hard time with. But what's happening is so interesting, and the book is so well written, and I really want to know sort of how they come together. So I'm absolutely going to stick with it. So it's funny how you can say I don't really like the characters, but I'm not saying I don't like the book. I'm saying they're really annoying. And they are. I'm glad they're not my sisters. So, well, this has been great, Lisa. I just want to say thank you. How can our listeners find you and follow you and hear, you know, what's going on with you?
I have a website, lisalevenstein.com. I can be found on Twitter at Lisa Levenstein. And I'm also starting a podcast about higher education and the untold stories of colleges and universities. And you can find that at collegelandpod.com.
That sounds great. All right. Well, you know, listeners, we're so glad you hung with us. If you've got questions or want to chat with us, the best thing to do is to come over to our Facebook group. It's not even hashtag. It's just plain AmWriting on Facebook. You can find more about the podcast at amwritingpodcast.com, where you can get on our email list so you get everything super fast, or support us and get our extra bonuses for writers every week. And that's who we are and what we do, and I'm letting Serena take us out.
Until next week, keep your butts in the chair and your heads in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause. Stop.
Thank you.